King Solomon's Mines by H. Rider Haggard. Produced by Audio Concepts of New York City. Performed by Patrick Horgan. Chapter 1. I Meet Sir Henry Curtis. It is a curious thing that at my age, 55 last birthday, I should find myself taking up a pen to try and write a history. I wonder what sort of a history it will be when I have done it. If I ever come to the end of the trip. I have done a good many things in my life, which seems a long one to me, owing to my having begun so young, perhaps. At an age when other boys are at school, I was earning my living as a trader in the old colony. I have been trading, hunting, fighting, or mining ever since, and yet it is only 8 months ago that I made my pile. It is a big pile, now I have got it. I don't yet know how big, but I don't think I would go through the last 15 or 16 months again for it. No, not if I knew that I should come out safe at the end, pile and all. But then, I am a timid man and don't like violence, and am pretty sick of adventure. I wonder why I am going to write this book. It is not in my line. I am not a literary man, though very devoted to the Old Testament, and also to the Inglesby legends. Let me try and set down my reasons, just to see if I have any. First reason, because Sir Henry Curtis and Captain John Good asked me to. Second reason, because I am laid up here at Durban with the pain and trouble in my left leg. Ever since that confounded lion got hold of me, I have been liable to it, and its being rather bad just now makes me limp more than ever. There must be some poison in a lion's teeth. Otherwise, how is it that when your wounds are healed, they break out again, generally, mark you, at the same time of year that you got your mauling? It is a hard thing that when one has shot 65 lions, as I have in the course of my life, that the 66th should chew your leg like a quid of tobacco. It breaks the routine of the thing, and putting other considerations aside, I am an orderly man and don't like that. This is, by the way. Third reason, because I want my boy Harry, who is over there at the hospital in London, studying to become a doctor, to have something to amuse him and keep him out of mischief for a week or so. Hospital work must sometimes pall and get rather dull, for even of cutting up dead bodies there must come satiety, and as this history won't be dull, whatever else it may be, it may put a little life into things for a day or two while he is reading it. Fourth reason, and last, because I am going to tell the strangest story that I know of. It may seem a queer thing to say that, especially considering that there is no woman in it, except Folata. Stop, though, there is Gargoula, if she was a woman and not a fiend. But she was 100 at least, and therefore not marriageable, so I don't count her. At any rate, I can safely say that there is not a petticoat in the whole history. Well, I had better come to the yoke. It's a stiff place, and I feel as though I were bogged up to the axle, but such is, as the Boers say. I'm sure I don't know how they spell it. Softly does it. A strong team will come through at last, that is, if they ain't too poor. You will never do anything with poor oxen. Now to begin. I, Alan Quatermain of Durban, Natal, gentlemen, make oath and say, that's how I began my deposition before the magistrate about poor Kiva's and Fentfurgle's sad deaths. But somehow it doesn't seem quite the right way to begin a book. And besides, am I a gentleman? What is a gentleman? I don't quite know, and yet I have had to do with niggers. No, I'll scratch that word niggers out, for I don't like it. I've known natives who are. And so you'll say, Harry, my boy, before you're done with this tale, and I have known mean whites with lots of money, and fresh out from home too, who ain't. Well, at any rate, I was born a gentleman, though I've been nothing but a poor travelling trader and hunter all my life. Whether I have remained so, I know not. You must judge of that. Heaven knows I've tried. I've killed many men in my time, but I have never slain wantonly or stained my hand in innocent blood, only in self-defence. The Almighty gave us our lives, and I suppose he meant us to defend them. At least I have always acted on that, and I hope it won't be brought up against me when my clock strikes. There, there, it is a wicked and a cruel world. and for a timid man I have been mixed up in a deal of slaughter. I can't tell the rights of it, but at any rate I have never stolen, though I once cheated a Kaffir out of a herd of cattle. But then he had done me a dirty turn, and it has troubled me ever since into the bargain. Well, it's 18 months or so ago since I first met Sir Henry Curtis and Captain Good, and it was in this way. I had been up elephant hunting beyond Bamangwato, and had had bad luck. Everything went wrong that trip. And to top up with, I got the fever badly. So soon as I was well enough, I trekked down to the Diamond Fields, sold such ivory as I had, and also my wagon and oxen, discharged my hunters, and took the post cart to the Cape. After spending a week in Cape Town, finding that they overcharged me at the hotel, and having seen everything there was to see, including the botanical gardens, which seemed to me likely to confer a great benefit on the country, and the new Houses of Parliament, which I expect will do nothing of the sort, I determined to go on back to Natal by the Dunkeld, then lying in the docks, waiting for the Edinburgh Castle due in from England. I took my berth and went aboard, and that afternoon the Natal passengers from the Edinburgh Castle transshipped, and we weighed anchor and put out to sea. Among the passengers who came on board there were two who excited my curiosity. One, a man of about 30, was one of the biggest-chested and longest-armed men I ever saw. He had yellow hair, a big yellow beard, clear-cut features, and large grey eyes set deep into his head. I never saw a finer-looking man, and somehow he reminded me of an ancient Dane. Not that I know much of ancient Danes, though I remember a modern Dane, who did me out of £10, but I remember once seeing a picture of some of those gentry, who, I take it, were a kind of white Zulus. They were drinking out of big horns, and their long hair hung down their backs, and as I looked at my friend standing there by the companion ladder, I thought that if one only let his hair grow a bit, put one of those chain shirts onto those great shoulders of his, and gave him a battle-axe and a horn mug, he might have sat as a model for that picture. And by the way, it is a curious thing, and just shows how the blood will show out. I found out afterwards that Sir Henry Curtis, for that was the big man's name, was of Danish blood. He also reminded me strongly of somebody else. But at the time, I could not remember who it was. The other man who stood talking to Sir Henry was short, stout, and dark, and of a different cut. I suspected at once that he was a naval officer. I don't know why, but it is difficult to mistake a navy man. I have gone shooting trips with several of them in the course of my life, and they have always been just the best and bravest and nicest fellows I ever met, though given to the use of profane language. I asked a page or two back, "What is a gentleman?" I'll answer it now. A Royal Naval Officer is, in a general sort of a way, though, of course, there may be a black sheep among them here and there. I fancy it is just the wide sea and the breath of God's winds that washes their hearts and blows the bitterness out of their minds and makes them what men ought to be. Well, to return. I was right again. I found out that he was a naval officer, a lieutenant of 31, who, after 17 years' service, had been turned out of Her Majesty's employ with the barren honour of a commander's rank, because it was impossible that he should be promoted. This is what people who serve the Queen have to expect, to be shot out into the cold world, to find a living just when they are beginning to really understand their work, and to get to the prime of life. Well, I suppose they don't mind it, but for my part, I had rather earn my bread as a hunter. One's halfpence are as scarce, perhaps, but you don't get so many kicks. His name, I found out by referring to the passengers' list, was Good, Captain John Good. He was broad, of medium height, dark, stout, and rather a curious man to look at. He was so very neat, and so very clean-shaved, and he always wore an eyeglass in his right eye. It seemed to grow there, for it had no string, and he never took it out except to wipe it. At first I thought he used to sleep in it, but I afterwards found that this was a mistake. He put it in his trousers pocket when he went to bed, together with his false teeth, of which he had two beautiful sets that have often, my own being none of the best, caused me to break the 10th commandment. But I am anticipating. Soon after we had got under way, evening closed in, and brought with it very dirty weather. A keen breeze sprang up off land, and a kind of aggravated Scotch mist soon drove everybody from the deck. And as for that Dunkeld, she is a flat-bottomed punt, and going up light as she was, she rolled very heavily. It almost seemed as though she would go right over, but she never did. It was quite impossible to walk about. So I stood near the engines, where it was warm, and amused myself with watching the pendulum, which was fixed opposite to me, swinging slowly backward and forward as the vessel rolled, and marked the angle she touched at each lurch. "That pendulum's wrong. It is not properly weighted," suddenly said a voice at my shoulder, somewhat testily. Looking round, I saw the naval officer I had noticed when the passengers came aboard. "Indeed? Now, what makes you think so?" I asked. "Think so? I don't think at all. Why, there!" as she righted herself after a roll. "If the ship had really rolled to the degree that thing pointed to, then she would never have rolled again, that's all. But it is just like these merchant skippers. They are always so confoundedly careless." Just then the dinner bell rang, and I was not sorry, for it is a dreadful thing to have to listen to an officer of the Royal Navy when he gets on to that subject. I only know one worse thing, and that is to hear a merchant skipper express his candid opinion of officers of the Royal Navy. Captain Good and I went down to dinner together, and there we found Sir Henry Curtis already seated. He and Captain Good sat together, and I sat opposite to them. The captain and I soon got into talk about shooting and what not, he asking me many questions, and I answering as well as I could. Presently he got on to elephants. "Ah, sir," called out somebody who was sitting near me, "you've got to the right man for that. Hunter Quatermain should be able to tell you about elephants if anybody can." Sir Henry, who had been sitting quite quiet, listening to our talk, started visibly. "Excuse me, sir," he said, leaning forward across the table and speaking in a low, deep voice, a very suitable voice, it seemed to me, to come out of those great lungs. "Excuse me, sir, but is your name Alan Quatermain?" I said it was. The big man made no further remark, but I heard him mutter, "Fortunate," into his beard. Presently dinner came to an end, and as we were leaving the saloon, Sir Henry came up and asked me if I would come into his cabin and smoke a pipe. I accepted, and he led the way to the Dunkeld deck cabin, and a very good cabin it was. It had been two cabins, but when Sir Garnet, or one of those big swells, went down the coast in the Dunkeld, they had knocked away the partition and never put it up again. There was a sofa in the cabin, and a little table in front of it. Sir Henry sent the steward for a bottle of whisky, and the three of us sat down and lit our pipes. "Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry Curtis, when the steward had brought the whisky and lit the lamp, "the year before last, about this time, you were, I believe, at a place called Bamangwato, to the north of the Transvaal?" "I was," I answered, rather surprised that this gentleman should be so well acquainted with my movements, which were not, so far as I was aware, considered of general interest. "You were trading there, were you not?" put in Captain Good in his quick way. "I was. I took up a wagon load of goods and made a camp outside the settlement and stopped till I had sold them." Sir Henry was sitting opposite to me, in a Madeira chair, his arms leaning on the table. He now looked up, fixing his large grey eyes full upon my face. There was a curious anxiety in them, I thought. "Did you happen to meet a man called Neville there?" "Oh, yes. He outspanned alongside of me for a fortnight, to rest his oxen before going on to the interior. I had a letter from a lawyer a few months back asking me if I knew what had become of him, which I answered to the best of my ability at the time." "Yes," said Sir Henry. "Your letter was forwarded to me. You said in it that the gentleman called Neville left Bamangwato in the beginning of May in a wagon with a driver, a voorlooper, and a Kaffir hunter called Jim, announcing his intention of trekking, if possible, as far as Inyati, the extreme trading post in the Matabele country, where he would sell his wagon and proceed on foot. You also said that he did sell his wagon. For 6 months afterwards, you saw the wagon in the possession of a Portuguese trader, who told you that he had bought it at Inyati from a white man whose name he had forgotten. and that the white man with a native servant had started off for the interior on a shooting trip, he believed.
Yes?
Then came a pause. "Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry suddenly, "I suppose you know, or can guess nothing more, of the reasons of Mr. Neville's journey to the northward, or as to what point that journey was directed?"
"I heard something," I answered, and stopped. The subject was one which I did not dare to discuss.
Sir Henry and Captain Good looked at each other, and Captain Good nodded. "Mr. Quatermain," said the former, "I'm going to tell you a story and ask your advice, and perhaps your assistance. The agent who forwarded me your letter told me that I might implicitly rely upon it, as you were," he said, "well known and universally respected in Natal, and especially noted for your discretion." I bowed and drank some whisky and water to hide my confusion, for I am a modest man, and Sir Henry went on, "Mr. Neville was my brother."
"Oh,"
I said, starting, for now I knew who Sir Henry had reminded me of when I first saw him. His brother was a much smaller man, and had a dark beard, but now I thought of it, he possessed eyes of the same shade of grey, and with the same keen look in them, and the features, too, were not unlike. "He was," went on Sir Henry, "my only and younger brother, and till 5 years ago, I do not suppose, we were ever a month away from each other. But just about 5 years ago a misfortune befell us, as sometimes does happen in families. We had quarrelled bitterly, and I behaved very unjustly to my brother in my anger." Here Captain Good nodded his head vigorously to himself. The ship gave a big roll just then, so that the looking-glass which was fixed opposite us to starboard was for a moment nearly over our heads, and as I was sitting with my hands in my pockets and staring upward, I could see him nodding like anything. "As I dare say you know," went on Sir Henry, "if a man dies intestate, and has no property but land, real property it is called in England, it all descends to his eldest son. It so happened that just at the time when we quarrelled, our father died intestate. He had put off making his will until it was too late. The result was that my brother, who had not been brought up to any profession, was left without a penny. Of course it would have been my duty to provide for him, but at the time the quarrel between us was so bitter that I did not, to my shame I say it," and he sighed deeply, "offer to do anything. It was not that I grudged him anything, but I waited for him to make advances, and he made none. I'm sorry to trouble you with all this, Mr. Quatermain, but I must, to make things clear, eh, Good?"
"Quite so, quite so," said the captain. "Mr. Quatermain will, I am sure, keep this history to himself."
"Of course," said I, for I rather pride myself on my discretion. "Well," went on Sir Henry, "my brother had a few £100 to his account at the time, and without saying anything to me, he drew out this paltry sum, and having adopted the name of Neville, started off for South Africa, in the wild hope of making a fortune. This I heard afterwards. Some 3 years passed, and I heard nothing of my brother, though I wrote several times. Doubtless the letters never reached him. But as time went on, I grew more and more troubled about him. I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that blood is thicker than water."
"That's true," said I, thinking of my boy Harry.
"I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that I would have given half my fortune to know that my brother George, the only relation I have, was safe and well, and that I should see him again."
"But you never did, Curtis,"
jerked out Captain Good, glancing at the big man's face.
"Well, Mr. Quatermain, as time went on, I became more and more anxious to find out if my brother was alive or dead, and if alive, to get him home again. I set inquiries on foot, and your letter was one of the results. So far as it went, it was satisfactory, for it showed that till lately George was alive. But it did not go far enough, so to cut a long story short, I made up my mind to come out and look for him myself, and Captain Good was so kind as to come with me."
"Yes," said the captain. "Nothing else to do, you see. Turned out by my lords of the Admiralty to starve on half pay. And now, perhaps, sir, you will tell us what you know or have heard of the gentleman called Neville." Chapter 2. The Legend of Solomon's Mines.
"What was it that you heard about my brother's journey at Bamangwato?" said Sir Henry, as I paused to fill my pipe before answering Captain Good.
"I heard this," I answered, "and I have never mentioned it to a soul till today. I heard that he was starting for Solomon's Mines."
"Solomon's Mines!" ejaculated both my heroes at once. "Where are they?"
"I don't know," I said.
"I know where they are said to be. I once saw the peaks of the mountains that border them, but there was 130 miles of desert between me and them, and I am not aware that any white man ever got across it, save one. But perhaps the best thing I can do is to tell you the legend of Solomon's Mines as I know it, you passing your word not to reveal anything I tell you without my permission. Do you agree to that? I have my reasons for asking it." Sir Henry nodded, and Captain Good replied, "Certainly, certainly." "Well," I began, "as you may guess, in a general way, elephant hunters are a rough set of men and don't trouble themselves with much beyond the facts of life and the ways of Kaffirs. But here and there you meet a man who takes the trouble to collect traditions from the natives and tries to make out a little piece of the history of this dark land. It was such a man as this who first told me the legend of Solomon's Mines, now a matter of nearly 30 years ago. It was when I was on my first elephant hunt in the Matabele country. His name was Evans, and he was killed next year, poor fellow, by a wounded buffalo, and lies buried near the Zambezi Falls. I was telling Evans one night, I remember, of some wonderful workings I had found while hunting kudu and eland in what is now the Lydenburg district of the Transvaal. I see they have come across these workings again lately in prospecting for gold, but I knew of them years ago. There is a great wide wagon road cut out of the solid rock and leading to the mouth of the working or gallery. Inside the mouth of this gallery are stacks of gold quartz piled up ready for crushing, which shows that the workers, whoever they were, must have left in a hurry. And about 20 paces in, the gallery is built across, and a beautiful bit of masonry it is." "Aye," said Evans, "but I will tell you a queerer thing than that." And he went on to tell me how he had found in the far interior a ruined city, which he believed to be the Ophir of the Bible. And, by the way, other more learned men have said the same long since poor Evans's time. I was, I remember, listening open-eared to all these wonders, for I was young at the time. And this story of an ancient civilization, and of the treasure which those old Jewish or Phoenician adventurers used to extract from a country long since lapsed into the darkest barbarism, took a great hold upon my imagination, when suddenly he said to me, 'Lad, did you ever hear of the Suleiman Mountains up to the northwest of the Mushikulumwe country?' I told him I never had. 'Ah, well,' he said, 'that was where Solomon really had his mines. His diamond mines, I mean.' 'How do you know that?' I asked. 'Know it? Why, what is Suleiman but a corruption of Solomon, and besides, an old Isanusi, witch doctor, up in the Manica country, told me all about it. She said that the people who lived across those mountains were a branch of the Zulus, speaking a dialect of Zulu, but finer and bigger men even, that there lived among them great wizards who had learned their art from white men when all the world was dark, and who had the secret of a wonderful mine of bright stones.' Well, I laughed at this story at the time, though it interested me, for the diamond fields were not discovered then, and poor Evans went off and got killed. And for 20 years I never thought any more of the matter. But just 20 years afterwards, and that is a long time, gentlemen, an elephant hunter does not often live for 20 years at his business, I heard something more definite about Suleiman's Mountains and the country which lies beyond them. I was up beyond the Manica country at a place called Sitanda's Kraal, and a miserable place it was, for one could get nothing to eat there, and there was but little game about. I had an attack of fever, and was in a bad way generally, when one day a Portuguese arrived with a single companion, a half-breed. Now I know your Delagoa Portuguese well. There is no greater devil unhung, in a general way, battening as he does upon human agony and flesh in the shape of slaves. But this was quite a different type of man to the low fellows I had been accustomed to meet. He reminded me more of the polite dons I have read about. He was tall and thin, with large dark eyes and curling grey moustache. We talked together a little, for he could speak broken English, and I understood a little Portuguese. And he told me that his name was José Silvestre, and that he had a place near Delagoa Bay. And when he went on next day with his half-breed companion, he said, "Goodbye," taking off his hat quite in the old style. "Goodbye, senor," he said. "If ever we meet again, I shall be the richest man in the world, and I will remember you." I laughed a little. I was too weak to laugh much, and watched him strike out for the great desert to the west, wondering if he was mad, or what he thought he was going to find there. A week passed, and I got the better of my fever. One evening I was sitting on the ground in front of the little tent I had with me, chewing the last leg of a miserable fowl I had bought from a native for a bit of cloth worth 20 fowls, and staring at the hot red sun sinking down into the desert, when suddenly I saw a figure, apparently that of a European, for it wore a coat, on the slope of the rising ground opposite to me, about 300 yards away. The figure crept along on its hands and knees. Then it got up and staggered along a few yards on its legs, only to fall and crawl along again. Seeing that it must be somebody in distress, I sent one of my hunters to help him, and presently he arrived. And who do you suppose it turned out to be? José Silvestre, of course, said Captain Good. Yes, José Silvestre, or rather his skeleton, and a little skin. His face was bright yellow with bilious fever, and his large dark eyes stood nearly out of his head, for all his flesh had gone. There was nothing but yellow, parchment-like skin, white hair, and the gaunt bones sticking up beneath. "Water, for the sake of Christ, water," he moaned. And I saw that his lips were cracked, and his tongue, which protruded between them, was swollen and blackish. I gave him water with a little milk in it, and he drank it in great gulps, 2 quarts or more without stopping. I would not let him have any more. Then the fever took him again, and he fell down and began to rave about Suleiman's mountains and the diamonds and the desert. I took him into the tent and did what I could for him, which was little enough. But I saw how it must end. About 11 o'clock he got quieter, and I lay down for a little rest and went to sleep. At dawn I woke again and saw him in the half-light sitting up, a strange, gaunt form, and gazing out towards the desert. Presently the first ray of the sun shot right across the wide plain before us, till it reached the faraway crest of one of the tallest of the Suleiman Mountains, more than 100 miles away. "There it is," cried the dying man in Portuguese, stretching out his long, thin arm. "But I shall never reach it, never, no one will ever reach it." Suddenly he paused and seemed to take a resolution. "Friend," he said, turning towards me, "are you there? My eyes grow dark." "Yes," I said, "yes." "Lie down now and rest." "Aye," he answered, "I shall rest soon. I have time to rest, all eternity. Listen, I am dying. You have been good to me. I will give you the paper. Perhaps you will get there if you can live through the desert, which has killed my poor servant and me." Then he groped in his shirt and brought out what I thought was a Boer tobacco pouch of the skin of the Swartwitpens, sable antelope. It was fastened with a little strip of hide, what we call a rimpi, and this he tried to untie but could not. He handed it to me. "Untie it," he said. I did so, and extracted a bit of torn yellow linen on which something was written in rusty letters. Inside was a paper. Then he went on feebly, for he was growing weak. "The paper has it all. That is on the rag. It took me years to read. Listen. My ancestor, a political refugee from Lisbon, and one of the first Portuguese who landed on these shores, wrote that when he was dying on those mountains,
which no white foot ever pressed before or since. His name was José de Silvestre, and he lived 300 years ago. His slave, who waited for him on this side the mountains, found him dead and brought the writing home to Delagoa. It has been in the family ever since, but none have cared to read it till at last I did. And I have lost my life over it, but another may succeed and become the richest man in the world. The richest man in the world, only give it to no one. Go yourself. Then he began to wander again, and in an hour it was all over. God rest him. He died very quietly. And I buried him deep with big boulders on his breast, so I do not think that the jackals can have dug him up. And then I came away. "Aye, but the document," said Sir Henry, in a tone of deep interest. "Yes, the document. What was in it?" "Well, gentlemen, if you like, I will tell you. I have never showed it to anybody yet, except my dear wife, who is dead, and she thought it was all nonsense, and a drunken old Portuguese trader who translated it for me, and had forgotten all about it next morning. The original rag is at my home in Durban, together with poor Don José's translation. But I have the English rendering in my pocket-book, and a facsimile of the map. If it can be called a map, here it is. I, José da Silvestra, who am now dying of hunger in the little cave where no snow is, on the north side of the nipple of the southernmost of the two mountains I have named Sheba's Breasts, write this in the year 1590, with a cleft bone upon a remnant of my raiment, my blood being the ink. If my slave should find it when he comes, and should bring it to Delagoa, let my friend, name illegible, bring the matter to the knowledge of the king, that he may send an army which, if they live through the desert and the mountains, and can overcome the brave Cacuanas and their devilish arts, to which end many priests should be brought, will make him the richest king since Solomon. With my own eyes have I seen the countless diamonds stored in Solomon's treasure chamber behind the White Death. But through the treachery of Gagul, the witch-finder, I might bring naught away, scarcely my life. Tell him who comes, follow the map, and climb the snow of Sheba's left breast till he comes to the nipple, on the north side of which is the great road Solomon made, from whence 3 days' journey to the king's palace. Let him kill Gagul, pray for my soul, farewell. José da Silvestra. When I had finished reading the above and shown the copy of the map, drawn by the dying hand of the old Don with his blood for ink, there followed a silence of astonishment. "Well," said Captain Good, "I have been round the world twice and put in at most ports, but may I be hung if I ever heard a yarn like that, out of a story-book or in it either, for the matter of that." "It's a queer story, Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry. "I suppose you are not hoaxing us. It is, I know, sometimes thought allowable to take a greenhorn in." "If you think that, Sir Henry," I said, much put out and pocketing my paper, for I do not like to be thought one of those silly fellows who consider it witty to tell lies, and who are forever boasting to newcomers of extraordinary hunting adventures which never happened. "Why, there is an end of the matter," and I rose to go. Sir Henry laid his large hand upon my shoulder. "Sit down, Mr. Quatermain," he said. "I beg your pardon. I see very well you do not wish to deceive us, but the story sounded so extraordinary that I could hardly believe it." "You shall see the original map and writing when we reach Durban," I said, somewhat mollified. For really, when I came to consider the matter, it was scarcely wonderful that he should doubt my good faith. "But I have not told you about your brother. I knew the man, Jim, who was with him. He was a Bechuana by birth, a good hunter, and for a native a very clever man. The morning Mr. Neville was starting, I saw Jim standing by my wagon and cutting up tobacco on the Disselboom. 'Jim,' said I, 'where are you off to this trip? Is it elephants?' 'No, boss,' he answered. 'We are after something worth more than ivory.' 'And what might that be?' I said, for I was curious. 'Is it gold?' 'No, boss. Something worth more than gold.' And he grinned. I did not ask any more questions, for I did not like to lower my dignity by seeming curious, but I was puzzled. Presently, Jim finished cutting his tobacco. "Boss," said he. I took no notice. "Boss," said he again. "Eh, boy, what is it?" said I. "Boss, we are going after diamonds." "Diamonds? Why, then, you're going in the wrong direction. You should head for the fields." "Boss, have you ever heard of Suleimansburg?" "Solomon's Mountains." "Aye." "Have you ever heard of the diamonds there?" "I have heard a foolish story, Jim." "It is no story, boss. I once knew a woman who came from there and got to Natal with her child, she told me. She is dead now." "Your master will feed the aasvogels, vultures, Jim, if he tries to reach Suleiman's country, and so will you, if they can get any pickings off your worthless old carcass," said I. He grinned. "Mayhap, boss. Man must die. I'd rather like to try a new country myself. The elephants are getting worked out about here." "Ah, my boy," I said, "you wait till the pale old man, Death, gets a grip of your yellow throat, and then we'll hear what sort of a tune you sing." Half an hour after that, I saw Neville's wagon move off. Presently, Jim came running back. "Goodbye, boss," he said. "I didn't like to start without bidding you goodbye, for I dare say you are right, and we shall never come back again." "Is your master really going to Suleimansburg, Jim, or are you lying?" "No," says he, "he is going. He told me he was bound to make his fortune somehow or try to, so he might as well try the diamonds." "Oh," said I. "Wait a bit, Jim. Will you take a note to your master, Jim, and promise not to give it to him until you reach Inyati, which was some 100 miles off?" "Yes," said he. So I took a scrap of paper and wrote on it, "Let him who comes climb the snow of Sheba's left breast till he comes to the nipple, on the north side of which is Solomon's great road." "Now, Jim," I said, "when you give this to your master, tell him he had better follow the advice implicitly. You are not to give it to him now, because I don't want him back asking me questions which I won't answer. Now be off, you idle fellow. The wagon is nearly out of sight." Jim took the note and went. "And that is all I know about your brother, Sir Henry. But I am much afraid, Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry, "I am going to look for my brother. I am going to trace him to Suleiman's Mountains and over them, if necessary, until I find him, or until I know that he is dead. Will you come with me? I am, as I think I have said, a cautious man, indeed a timid one, and I shrank from such an idea. It seemed to me that to start on such a journey would be to go to certain death, and putting other things aside, as I had a son to support, I could not afford to die just then. No, thank you, Sir Henry." "I think I had rather not," I answered. "I am too old for wild goose chases of that sort, and we should only end up like my poor friend Silvestri. I have a son dependent on me, so cannot afford to risk my life." Both Sir Henry and Captain Good looked very disappointed. "Mr. Quatermain," said the former, "I am well off, and I am bent upon this business. You may put the remuneration for your services at whatever figure you like, in reason, and it shall be paid over to you before we start. Moreover, I will, before we start, arrange that in the event of anything happening to us or to you, your son shall be suitably provided for. You will see from this how necessary I think your presence. Also, if by any chance we should reach this place and find diamonds, they shall belong to you and Good equally. I do not want them. But, of course, the chance is as good as nothing, though the same thing would apply to any ivory we might get. You may pretty well make your own terms with me, Mr. Quatermain. Of course, I shall pay all expenses." "Sir Henry," said I, "this is the most liberal offer I ever had, and one not to be sneezed at by a poor hunter and trader. But the job is the biggest I ever came across, and I must take time to think it over. I will give you my answer before we get to Durban." "Very good," answered Sir Henry. And then I said good night and turned in, and dreamed about poor long-dead Silvestri and the diamonds.